On this edition of the College Football Inquirer, Michigan has hired a coach, and it's a guy that probably would not have gotten the job if this were just 2 years ago. Also, we preview two college football playoff quarterfinals. We got two today, two on Tuesday. We're going with the left side of the bracket today, so we'll leave Alabama and Indiana in the Rose Bowl, Texas Tech and Oregon in the Orange Bowl. We'll preview those two games because those two teams, the winners of those games, will be matching up in a semifinal. And there is all manner of subplots in these games, even though Michigan is hard to coach, so the Kalen DeBoer stuff can finally die. But we got to talk about all of it right now on the College Football Inquirer. This is the College Football Inquirer with Stephen Godfrey. I am Andy Staples. Ross Dellinger is fishing. I say that as Godfrey takes a drink.
Literally gone fishing.
Well, it's funny because one of us was going to miss today's show because of fishing. It was either going to be him or me. His trip got sprung on him sooner than my trip got sprung on me. And so I ended up being able to renegotiate the time, and he could not.
I have not fished at all. I guess I realize I'm in the landlocked area of this podcast. So no holiday fishing, although I wish I was right now.
Well, yeah. So I'm in Key Largo right now. I just wanted to get closer to the Orange Bowl. We'll be talking about that game later in the show. Nice. I am driving up to cover the Orange Bowl, which is amazing. It's that just my wife, two or three months ago, was like, hey, what would you think if we went to the Keys for a week after Christmas? I was like, yes. Oh, by the way, I have to work in Miami one day. And she's like, that's okay. We don't need you.
Man, you are like the Chamber of Commerce for like the not flurry in tourism, like actually like relocation right now. Because I think it's gonna be like 20 degrees in 2 days. Yeah. We're hunkering down for like an ice storm. So yeah, this is
they're preparing
man,
for
rub it in
quote unquote cold weather, because I think in Miami on game day the low is gonna be like 58 in the morning. I think
really
it's gonna be like 75. Yeah. It's gonna be beautiful.
Hey, one thing I noticed that I would like to applaud the playoff for, because I don't feel like there's not a ton of positivity, at least from my end sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
The next couple years, warm weather sites. Warm weather yes. sites, guys, we're figuring it out, right? Well, we're going to be in Miami this year. We've got Vegas, we've got Tampa, we got Miami again. There's New Orleans. I don't think that's the sequence. I know that Miami's bid and won another one. I think it's like 5 or 6 years from now, but that's great. We don't, Andy, were you at the Georgia Alabama final in Indianapolis?
I was not.
Okay. I had so many UGA fans in my life talk about how, oh man, that was the best sports moment of my life. And then I walked outside and it was 10 degrees and the wind was blowing in Indiana and there was nothing open.
In Indianapolis, wonderful big event city, but
yes,
not accustomed enough to the cold that when it gets really, really cold, they don't shut down a little bit. So,
right. Yeah.
Yeah. That's. Now, what I want is more cold weather in the first and second rounds. I want second round sites on campus. I want them out of the bowls. Hopefully that they can do that for us. But yes, I will enjoy the weather. I'm not going to lie. I will enjoy it very much this week. But one place where the weather is not typically great this time of year, Godfrey,
mm-mm.
is Ann Arbor, Michigan. But they're feeling warm and toasty right now because they got a coach. And I want you to tell me, because okay. I did a reaction video with Ari Wasserman at On Three on Friday about this hire. And I was, I think, somewhere between ecstatic and over the moon about Michigan's prospects in the future. And I watched it back and I thought, okay, was I a little over the top here? Am I too optimistic about this Kyle Whittingham hire? Because I love it. And I do realize there's a reason he was available, but I still love it.
Oof.
And I think somebody at Utah is either going to look really smart or really stupid when all is said and done.
Yes. It's hard not to talk about Michigan without talking about Utah.
Let's first
acknowledge the fact that if you're going to screw around or have an unfortunately timed search, or if you're going to take your time in the case of Penn State, it helps to be a helmet school. It helps to be a big budget, recognizable brand, because both Penn State and Michigan have sort of backed into really competent football hires in a way that the circumstances of their search almost said that they wouldn't. You kind of thought that the way that Penn State meandered, that they would end up with someone that was a little lackluster. They didn't. They got what everyone kind of feels like the right football guy.
The guy who Michigan would have gotten, by the way, Matt Campbell would have been who Michigan definitely. Would have just called Matt Campbell if he'd still been at Iowa State when Sharon Without Moore got a fired.
Doubt. Yeah, I can remember, and I can't remember exactly what season it was. Before the sort of last Harbaugh renaissance of his period in Ann Arbor, where there was a decent amount of speculation that maybe they should move on, right? Before he takes the pay cut and before they go on the run before the playoff. I guess this would have been two seasons before the playoff loss against Georgia. A lot of Michigan fans were, you know, asking questions on our podcast and sort of submitting questions like, what do you think about Matt Campbell? Like, what about Matt Campbell? You couldn't get Matt Campbell because Penn State, again, fell backwards into Matt Campbell. But you also got a guy who's as consistent and as respected and as football-centric.
I would argue more accomplished because Matt Campbell never won the Big 12 at Iowa State, which, look, I am a big Matt Campbell fan and believe he certainly outpunched his weight at Iowa State and made that program way better. But think about what Kyle Whittingham did. He took he's the only one who's taken a team from the group of five to a power conference and won multiple conference titles in that power conference. Gary Patterson, I guess, is the closest other one.
Definitely,
he shared the 2014 title at TCU. And then, but Kyle Whittingham took them from the Mountain West to the Pac-12, got them deep enough to compete in the Pac-12 fairly quickly. And then as the Pac-12 was dying, even though the Pac-12 had really good programs in Oregon, USC was very good that last year that Utah won the Pac-12 title. They were awesome at the end of the Pac-12.
I tried to do what you're doing, which is I tried to find I tried to cast as critical an eye as I could to Whittingham.
Mm-hmm.
And we can talk about the Michigan side of this for a second.
Yeah.
But the first initial criticism, at least like kind of that lazy social media kickback, was, well, he's never had to experience this, or he's never had to deal with this. And what's funny is, you know, I thought about that and I was like, yeah, you know, they're right. It's a unique situation. Then you go through his resume just as Utah's head coach. I'm not talking about anything before that. He essentially builds the best Mountain West program possible going into the 2010 changeover when they get annexed or drafted by the Pac-12, right? So they are the perennial G5, the stalwart. They are the team you don't want to see, and they start to build that reputation, the physicality, and like defensively they're playing kind of above their talent level. Then they go to the Pac-12, and what I find admirable or remarkable is that they're not great in the Pac-12 right away.
Five and seven, two years in a row.
Right. They take the criticism bump, and it takes them five seasons to get to 10 wins, but after they adjust and a couple years of recruiting at the power level, Whittingham does the thing that, he couldn't because it's a G5 program, right? Then guess what happens? They start winning in the Pac-12. They start becoming the nightmare team that you don't want to see, especially if you were like a Tiffany brand like USC, right? That was the team you didn't want to see in the Pac-12 championship. Then the rug gets pulled out from under them and the Pac-12 implodes. They go to a Big 12 that I've described before as sort of like a Vegas, you know, 2 a.m. Vegas buffet, where you don't really know what you've got in terms of a schedule and opponents, and you've kind of lost your equilibrium. They go 5-7 in 24, and they turn around and win 10 games under him this year. Had he stayed, Andy, had he stayed, we would be talking about him as a Big 12 contender next year and the year out. He would have done it again. So to push this to Michigan, this is definitely something he's never dealt with before. This is definitely an environment that's totally new to him. However, there are so few coaches at the head coaching level who have encountered so many systemic, like major changes, and then seen a program through adjusting and succeeding. I can't really think of another one. Patterson is probably the only comp that I could think of in the last 25 years.
And the thing about Whittingham is I don't think Michigan makes this hire 2 years ago. I don't think any major program, even in a situation where they just fired their coach under scandalous circumstances and they just need somebody right now, I don't think a major program like Michigan would hire a 66-year-old grandfather of 11. Until Kurt Cignetti showed them the way. Cignetti showed everybody that some guy in his 60s can come in and just win. And oh, by the way, the goal is not to win in 2 years. The goal is to win now. Like one of the things that Ari has hyped or harped on with me, and I think he's really right about this, is he always tells me, he's like, the window has changed. Before, you'd get 5 years to win, then 4 years to win, then 3 years to win. Now, if you don't have a winner by year two, you have blown the hire. Like, you already Correct. Know you've blown the hire. And it's not, it's because of the system now, because you can flip it so quickly. Like, when Florida didn't have a winner with Billy Napier in year two, you knew they'd blown the hire.
Yes.
So you Jonathan have to Smith. Hire some. Yes, Jonathan Smith at Michigan State. You have to hire someone who can win immediately. And so it doesn't matter that Kyle Whittingham is 66. It doesn't matter that Kyle Whittingham's not going to coach there 10 years. It doesn't matter.
No.
He can win now.
If this is a bridge coach, Andy, it's the best bridge coach you could have possibly imagined.
Yeah.
I know there's some potential like culture fit, that sort of abstract Michigan man nonsense or whatever. Do I think Kyle Whittingham is the coach of the future? No, but I think he's the coach of the present. And mm-hmm. if you have to, and we've talked about this, we've joked, we've hinted about it, we have no idea the level of, I don't know what you want to call it, internal revision, review. I mean, they're going to have to power wash this athletic department is from what yeah. everybody's hearing, right?
I would imagine it's a pretty thorough house cleaning. So like everybody who's there now in charge probably yeah. isn't there. And Kyle Whittingham can just win you some games while that's
Correct.
All going on.
Correct. If this is to be the next, let's say, 3 or 4 seasons, if this is to be a tumultuous sea change for Michigan athletics and Michigan football and all of the just everything that's not on the field, then this is the head coach you want, because this is the steadiest hand you could have possibly found. Now, let's go back for a second and talk about somebody like Kenny Dillingham, who was kicked around for this. I think you and I agree that Kenny Dillingham is as close to the ideal coach of the future candidate as we could get right
yeah.
now, right? We don't have trees yet. You know, we've talked about different trees, and you know, maybe it's Dan Lanning or you know, whatever. I don't know if had things gone differently in the negotiations with Dillingham, if that would have been best for either party right now, because for Michigan to really modernize top to bottom, left to right, they would need a ton of support, a ton of stability, and a ton of alignment. We use that word a lot, right?
Yep.
They're not in a position to offer alignment right now. And one of the things about Whittingham and the tumult that has occurred at Utah over the years, I'm not talking about scandal, I'm just talking about seismic change.
He doesn't care.
It doesn't matter.
He's Bane. You adopted the darkness. Yeah. I was born in it, brother. That's Kyle Whittingham. I mean,
but if you think about some of the more mush mouth complaints we hear from other coaches about, well, you know, this amount of uncertainty hurt our team, or we didn't know this was going to happen, or my contract's not extended long enough and it hurt me in recruiting. None of that has ever affected him. None of that has ever hurt the program long term. Now,
and if you've talked to people in the Utah Athletic Department and Kyle Whittingham over the years, it's not like they've had the Rosies relationship the whole time either.
No, which is where I want to go with this. Like, okay, congratulations to Michigan. You kind of slipped and fell into it the way Penn State did. Why is this man available?
Yes, yes. And would he be available if he had not stepped down at Utah, which was him stepping down with a bit of an elbow nudge, I think is not a pure shove, but kind of an elbow nudge.
You have to assume that no one in Salt Lake is happy about this, right? You thought that this was going to be the architect, the pioneer architect of modern Utah football is going to step down. Well, guys, he's 66. We want to get a younger voice in there. We want to embrace modernity, which, by the way, I say that as if I know that Whittingham has dug his heels in on some sort of adaption or change in the sport. That's not the case.
He hasn't. He hired a new OC who brought along a quarterback and a receiver last year. That's how you operate today.
He's changed that offense quite a bit. Yeah. It's so funny to me because he is so... It's hard to separate Whittingham from the identity of Utah football, which is the compliment that Utah football gets. So every year for I don't even know how many years now, I've done these anonymous coach surveys and you know little scouting reports and stuff for different magazines. And I do it now more as a way of sort of like kind of studying for the year to come. And I've never had a more consistent compliment from opposing coaches across 3 different conferences now. I've never seen a more consistent program in an assessment where I say, hey, can you give me something negative? And the negative thing is they're going to fight you like hell. They're violent. They're physical. No, we don't want to go to Salt Lake. We hate it there.
Right. They might not have enough NFL skill guys. That's really it. They've got everything else.
Utah is the program. Utah is the Iowa without the attention of the Big Ten. Utah is the ideal manufacturer culture program that we have seen. And I want to take this wide for a second, because Michigan can be this type of culture sometimes. We've seen it historically. I think they were when things were really clicking on the national title season, especially like that was a physical, violent team, line-based. It's funny to me that like Utah just gave this guy up and Michigan grabbed him. And it was extraordinary circumstances. But I start thinking about Wisconsin and the way that they decided to change their culture. And then I think about Iowa and the criticism that people like me give Iowa of like, when are you gonna be more than what you are, right? There are some programs where it's like, all right, be careful here. Because if you get tired of 9-10 in the occasional 11-win season and you aspire to more, sometimes that's the moment you run off the cliff and you don't realize it until you look down. And so I'm now kind of talking more about Utah now, but this is one of those moments, Andy, where like the entire time Brian Kelly was in Baton Rouge, you kept looking up to see what Notre Dame was doing, right? In the, because a referendum had occurred. And we now kind of have a big moment where everything that Utah does and Michigan does, they're going to be kind of tied together for the next 3 or 4 years.
Well, and look, people are going to go, oh, he went 5-7 in 2024. He did. He went 8-5 in 23 and 5-7 in 24. But if you understand the circumstances of those things, all of that goes back to they win the Pac-12, they play in the Rose Bowl, Cam Rising gets hurt in the Rose Bowl, and they know Cam Rising's not going to be back for the 23 season, or at least for the beginning of it. But they weren't entirely sure if he could make it back maybe by the end of it. And so that quarterback situation was weird. And then he's back for the 24 season. They probably, for the good of the program, should have said, hey, maybe you want to hit the portal. But they didn't. They brought him back. And then he gets hurt again. And that, remember, they didn't have a lot behind him. Probably because people didn't want to come in the transfer portal era because Cam Rising was there. And he'd won two Pac-12 titles for them. So that's where it went wrong. And Kyle Whittingham, I think, had talked about stepping down at that point and was like, I'm not leaving it like this. I'm not leaving like this. And then goes and fixes it by hiring Jason Beck as the offensive coordinator for New Mexico. He brings Devin Dampier, one of the receivers he brought. And they went and portaled quite a bit of skill talent. They had linemen. They had Spencer Fano, Caleb Lomu. Those guys are going to be, Spencer Fano is going to be first-round tackle. Caleb Lomu, maybe second-round guy. Like, they had really good players. Now you're going to give this guy money. You're going to give this guy a 5-star quarterback. I'm assuming Bryce Underwood stays.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's impossible to project if you don't. Let's assume he stays for a minute. I think there's a way to build quickly into a, oh gosh, I was about to say 8-9 game winner. This is where the Michigan asterisk
with
comes
Sharon
in.
With Sharon Moore doing what he was doing, God knows still fell ass backward to 9 wins.
Correct. So I think
you need to set the bar at least 10 this year.
I think it's 9 or 10 wins. I think it has to be going into next year. I think, you know, I'm going to be unpopular for saying this, but Ohio State operates at a talent level that's different most years, even from Michigan. But that game aside, you should be able to hold serve throughout conference play until you get to the game after Thanksgiving. It'll be fascinating to see if he can do it this quickly. We don't know as we record this how much turnover we're going to see at Michigan. And this is where I think his culture, right? The overused word culture. What kind of relationship can he build with that roster and how fast? Because he can't really, now this is where the challenge comes in. He can't really make this thing his own, okay? And at Utah, it very much was his representation of him.
But can he not? This is the other question. How scorched earth is Kyle Whittingham willing to go on Utah? Is he willing to do what Kurt Cignetti did to James Madison? Because if I'm Kyle Whittingham and somebody just nudged me out at Utah, I'm not feeling particularly sentimental about, even though Morgan Scalley played for me, I'm not feeling all that sentimental.
Well,
I might
Andy,
be
my
saying,
question,
hey, if y'all want to wear a winged helmet and come play for me, come on.
Well, then my question would be, if he has the capability of luring one-third of the top-end talent to bolster this roster right away, to carry his message in, because one of the other secrets of and we've talked about this at so many schools. I know we use Cignetti in Indiana as the sort of primary example, but it occurs a lot now. I've used like North Texas this year, basically imported the Sam Houston defense. And guess what? It got those guys a Big 12 job. When you do that, it's not just the talent level you're bringing in. It's also locker room messaging. And it's that sort of translation ability to just group of new players.
Schematic knowledge, too. That's well, the
yeah,
other part.
And it's 9 to 12 guys who are like, hey, I know what he means when he says this. By the way, this is what this, you know, this is, hey, this is our terminology on this. But my question is, if he can do that, if he could successfully lure 8, 9, 10, 12 guys from Utah, can I go back to the original question? Why did you get rid of him? If the roster at Utah has that buy-in level with him, then what? Why did we do this in the first place?
I like I said, someone's either going to look really smart or really stupid at Utah.
Yeah,
I'm glad you said 9 wins for Michigan after I said 10.
Okay,
I'm looking at the 26 schedule for Michigan again. I looked at it before.
Yeah,
I don't think I appreciated it fully. Michigan. Well, we know Michigan pissed off people in the Big Ten office, but this is a rough draw. Like we talked about, USC has a rough draw in 26. So does Michigan. They have Oklahoma coming in the non-conference, of course. That's the return date from this year's game. But at home, they get Indiana, Iowa, Michigan State, Penn State, UCLA. On the road, Minnesota, Ohio State, Oregon, and Rutgers. That's a rough Big Ten schedule.
This is a 9 win. This is you need to feel good about 9, but I will say this. Hey,
that's if you go 9-3, you might make a 16-team playoff if it's a 16-team playoff.
Yeah, that's where I was headed. Was this is also a 9-3 that isn't you're the first team out. It might be the last team in.
Yeah. So I am fascinated by this. And then again, you're going to give him money, resources. So we talk about the coordinators now. Also, if you know your Kyle Whittingham Utah history, you know there was a period where being the offensive coordinator at Utah was essentially like being the drummer for Spinal Tap. Like you might just burst into flames you just might instantaneously burst into flames.
Like, yes.
But Jason Beck, the OC who came to work for Whittingham last year, seems willing to come along to Michigan, which I think some of those other OCs, if you asked them after a year, would be like, nope. Not going with that guy. So that seems to have improved some. And then, oh, by the way, he'd like to get Jay Hill, the defensive coordinator from BYU, and it sounds like that might be a possibility.
The staff he could potentially put together, even in the later stages of assistant construction, because most of this is like kind of been done, or what happens is when a guy takes a head job, he's going to put 2 or 3 feelers out, and it's like, well, if this happens, I'm going to go with this guy here. Even with the lateness of this in the process, he would have, I mean, I don't even have to look this up. He would have the most amount of money he's ever had to put together a staff.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. He's hiring coordinators at over $2 million a year. Like you can pay your coordinators over $2 million a year.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because I just thought of the staff as a foregone conclusion. And I know there was some angst over the offense, and I'm not trying to downplay that, but because again, I'm not a football coach and I don't try and armchair analyze this stuff. But when I ask football coaches, they talk about how it's less that you have a 5-win season in the middle of a run. It's more about adjusting off of that. And when you look through his CV year to year, in addition to all the change that we talked about, when he's found a valley, they've always found a way to build out of it. So the idea of like the talent that he could bring in now, and I think the cachet of what they did this year alone, yeah, they're going to have a great staff. I am a little hung up on how does that translate to the existing roster? How quick, like, what is your internal message? What is the recruit the roster message? That feels like the most urgent thing right now in the next, yeah, like,
and that's
five
the thing. Like, you obviously
days.
want to keep Bryce Underwood. You want to keep some of that young, because Michigan had some good young players. Let's not mince words. Like, they want to keep a lot of that roster.
And I think that came with a different message and a completely different culture. So that's the only hiccup here. And it's not anything against Whittingham, because I think anyone that would have come in short of keeping Biff or keeping some consistency, which they don't want, you were going to have this challenge. So his big test to me, Andy, has nothing to do with football. And it has to do more with almost that sort of like internal PR messaging, because it is a talented and somewhat expensive roster as is. And for us to plug in 9 wins as cavalierly as we have, you need to have... You need to have the bones of what we saw this year, mostly still there next year.
Yeah, you need to be like, Andrew Marsh, you were amazing down the stretch. We want you here. How do we make sure you're here? And then we're going to go get some other guys to help you. So, you know, it'll feel more like, you know, Jeremiah and Carnell than you and maybe not anybody else. So, yeah, I think that's the thing. They've got to nail down the parts of this roster they want to keep. And they've got, you know, the calendar is not that unforgiving to them because the portal opens on Friday of this week. Like, he's been hired for 2 days now as we record this. That's not that short of a time. Like, you can get the business done you need to get done, ID what you're going to need in the portal, and go get it.
Yeah. We're in the honeymoon phase, and, like, you know, social media is a funhouse mirror and all that, but some of the anecdotal quotes I've seen from existing players on the roster, mainly on the lines, have said stuff like, I don't know a ton. Baby. They're like, most of the guys were like, well, I don't know him personally or anything like that. Cause, like, you know, a lot of guys at Michigan weren't recruited by Utah, but they're like, I know his reputation. Like, let's go.
I know he puts linemen in the league. That's what I know.
There's not a lot of like, oh, this is a weird guy who's got a social media personality. It's like, no, like, apparently this guy's a thumper. Like, let's go thump. That's not the word that I would use, but you get where I'm going with that.
A term that apparently some of your was your aunt's friends or your
So we've used this term FFC. The second F is football, and the C is coach. You can figure out what the other F is. Yes, Kyle Whittingham, certified historic FFC. But yeah, shout out to, I guess it's ECU Radio. On their bowl game win against Pitt, they shouted our show out and used the term FFC in relation to, by the way, what's been a fantastic turnaround at ECU football. We'll talk about that another time. But yeah, my mom had a friend from high school say, like, oh, they mentioned Steven, and they talked about how that coach was an FFC. And I was like, oh my God, a bunch of 70-year-old women are using the term FFC now. So
love it.
We need t-shirts. We need t-shirts.
Well, listen, the merch comes. We build the audience, then the merch comes. Don't you worry. And by the way, we also want that audience. You guys love listening to us. You can also watch us. You can see the waving coconut palms behind me if you go to the Yahoo Sports Network. So you turn on your smart TV on the home screen, you'll see a row of icons. Find that Yahoo Sports Network icon. You can watch all of our shows. Also, any device, anytime, day or night, yahoosports.tv is the address. And you can call up all of the Yahoo Sports Network shows and watch at your leisure. So if you want to watch College Football Inquirer, yahoosports.tv. And there I am in front of some palm trees. And there's Godfrey in his lovely Metallica shirt.
This was a Christmas present for my kids. You like that?
Creeping Death. Your kids are awesome. Love it.
Creeping Death. Fantastic song.
That was the first song they played when I saw them in Tampa this year. So there you go.
Same. They opened the set in Atlanta with that. And so I was like, yeah, it's also my favorite Metallica song.
There we go. When we return, we will be back in a stadium like I was for that Metallica show. We are going to Pasadena for the Rose Bowl, Alabama versus Indiana in one quarterfinal. We're going to preview the Rose and the Orange. Alabama, Indiana's next. We're back at the College Football Inquirer, and let us head to the Rose Bowl, the granddaddy of them all. Alabama and Indiana, not a matchup, but that's Godfrey. It sounds like a one-off Rose Bowl matchup from the 20s, is what it sounds like. The 1920s, not the current 20s.
Oh no, it sounds like a bowl game that involved trains.
Definitely trains and possibly a rum brand. Yes,
absolutely. Yeah, and then they played like Navy and some sort of Wing Academy thing like 2 days later, and someone died of polio.
But no, that is the number one versus number nine game because Alabama won the 8-9 game. So number one seed versus number nine seed. Indiana is favored by a touchdown in this game, which is another thing that if you traveled back in time 5 years and told them, like, hey, Michigan's going to hire a 66-year-old Kyle Whittingham. And oh, by the way, Indiana's going to be favored by 7 against Alabama in the Rose Bowl. people would have you committed.
Here's where I want to start. The thing about Cignetti that, like, it's not the portal wizardry. It's there's such a quiet consistency in the program that makes it that, like, he gets the Saban-esque label a lot lately. But I'm going through and I'm reading preview stuff, and it's like Indiana players, clearly there's an internal memo that any talk about analyzing this year's Alabama team is like total respect and deference, right? So right. All of the quotes coming out of the last media veil for Indiana are, hey, it's still Bama. They're Alabama. They got a ton of great athletes. Like, you could, it's funny because, like, you know, you and I do this for a living. You can tell what question was posed even without reading it, like, to what the answer was. Like, you can tell they're trying to say, like, hey, what did you see out of that Oklahoma game? Or they've struggled doing this, they've struggled doing that. And no, it's been a lockstep uniform, like zero bulletin board, zero Big Ten versus SEC nonsense. All of the tropey stuff that this game, we sort of want to put on this game. Indiana has been incredibly quiet because, Andy, I think they're the better team.
Well, I think they're probably the better team, but I also think they're smart enough to know when they turn on the tape that Alabama has the athletes to beat them on the right day.
And absolutely.
That's the thing that you have to respect and you have to be careful of. And if you do respect it properly and you're the better team, then you do eliminate some of the element of surprise. And so there's a stat I go to for Indiana that I find to be just amazing in a lot of ways. But so you remember how mad Cignetti was after the Old Dominion game? That was the season opener. They won it 27-14. Old Dominion ran 23 times for 218 yards in that game. It was a 9.5 per carry average. He scored 2 touchdowns on the ground. It was an abomination of a performance by the Indiana defense by Kurt Cignetti standards. Do you know, Stephen, what the largest yards per carry figure Indiana gave up the rest of the season was? And mind you, they played Oregon and Ohio State.
Oof, like yards per rush.
Yards per carry in a game.
Is it under 5?
It is 3.6.
Oh, okay, I wanted to say under 4, but that felt preposterous.
It does, exactly. So Penn State averaged 3.6. Ohio State averaged 2.2. Oregon averaged 2.7. These are teams that run the ball very well on decent competition.
Well, if
and
I
they got destroyed,
if I wasn't recording from home, I'd take this lovely iced tea and do a spit take when I look at, oh, well, surely Alabama's run game has been success. Ah, okay, that's right. It's
yes.
not Alabama's run game
and
of yours.
And that is what I'm getting at. Alabama struggles to run the ball. Even after the Daniel Hill 30-yard run and the 6-yard touchdown at the end, they still only averaged 1.1 yards a carry against Oklahoma. Now that also backs out sacks. But remember, they were sitting at like -3, and they did it. They did gain -3 yards on the ground against Georgia. So the Auburn game, they were respectable running the ball, but there's not really been a game against a good team where they've actually been good running the ball.
No, man, there's recency bias. And then there's also that, I think we misapply individual game context when we're previewing the next. But yet I still feel like hesitant to do this on a podcast. What Alabama put on tape against OU, despite the win, and I think the win can be explained a little bit by they do have that raw talent ability to just snap up and get you. Like the block punt, for instance, that's a single play of pure talent that then flipped all the momentum. And Oklahoma, I think Oklahoma's offense was not competent enough to respond. But however, if you are Indiana and you have shown the ability, especially in big games this season, to sort of stultify that and prevent that from happening, then everything that every area in which Alabama has struggled down the stretch would favor Indiana significantly. So what I'm trying to kind of talk my way out of is, despite down 17-0 on the road in the playoffs, hostile environment, et cetera, when you pull that out and you get kind of sober about it, I still think this matchup favors Indiana significantly.
I think it does too. What you've got to do if you're Alabama is you've got to make Fernando Mendoza make mistakes. Yeah. Alabama capitalized on, I don't know whose mistake it was, whether it was John Mateer's mistake or the receiver's mistake, but you had the situation where clearly Mateer changed something before the play. The communication did not get to the receiver. He throws the pick 6. Like, you need something like that. You need to create it, like they created the block punt. They need to create some havoc if they're going to win this game. Because if they let Fernando Mendoza just tear them apart, they're not going to be able to control the ball long enough to deal with that, because Indiana will get too many possessions. They will have the ball too many times to stop. And the Ty Simpson we need, Godfrey,
is the
Vanderbilt game Ty Simpson. Vandy game Ty Simpson.
Yes.
If that dude shows up, Alabama's got a chance. Because that dude was 23 of 31, 340 yards. He averaged 11 yards per attempt, 2 TDs and a pick. He was dealing that. And that was the and remember, he's at that game, at that point, he's coming off that Georgia game where he was unbelievable on third and fourth down. In the Vandy game, also unbelievable on third and fourth down. Like, that's the Ty Simpson that has to be there. Otherwise, it's not going to work. Because Alabama, I mean, Ty Simpson averaged 7.7 yards per attempt. That is decidedly average. And when you're a team that can't run the ball playing against a good defense, you got to get more than that out of your passing game.
You're talking about the Vanderbilt game, too. It's also, it's not just the Ty Simpson, it's the offensive line that has, you know, just not looked as good, not been as consistent. Was not the SEC championship game. That was not the same offensive line. So I think it's that. I also, defensively, like, again, as amateur analysis here, Kane Womack does some really fun stuff. Like, he does some really deceptive, wild stuff on defense. And that's kind of what hung Mateer out, I think, was trying to make it like pre-snap evaluations. And they move around a lot, and they disguise a lot of what they're doing. That's, they're not beyond confusing Mendoza.
Right.
But isn't it scary to what we're talking about is the game has to hinge on creating like a fairly complex situation, which is like forcing the Heisman winner into a really bad decision because you're going out there and disguising schemes when Indiana could just get very simple and kind of lean and win the game actually in a very sort of old school Alabama way.
Well, and that's the thing. We keep coming back to this, and we don't, there's no need to dance around it. Indiana does to teams what Alabama under Nick Saban did to teams, where they don't have these off games. They don't have random off games. They show up. They're pretty much the same every game. They perform consistently. They perform to a high standard almost every game. Like, that's what Kurt Cignetti has made Indiana into. I mean, what's Indiana's worst game this year? Was it maybe either Penn State or Iowa, I guess?
Probably Penn State I would say Penn State, just because of the given what that Penn State team was, although they just closed out the season on a win streak. So maybe we're undervaluing the Penn State in transition there. But yeah, no, they are built for consistency, but they're also designed not to have those mental lapses. It's very first era Saban Alabama, where they just want to sort of, like, we called it the crock pot, you know, when it was just as like, it's a slow demise where nothing is ever.
They would love to run for 300 yards and throw the ball 22 times.
Yeah, Mark Ingram, handed like that era Alabama. Which, by the way, infuriating, not the most fun thing to watch if you're a hockey fan. Reminds me of like the neutral zone trap, but pretty. Hey,
go New Jersey Devils of that era.
When you have a lot of really good athletes and your line's dominant, it's also the shortest. It's the shortest path to victory, which coaches tend to take.
Yeah. One point, LT Overton, Alabama defensive lineman, should be back for this game. So that will help in terms of Alabama creating chaos. Having one of their best defensive linemen back in the game, certainly important. So,
yes. SEC homer, dumb talking point, whatever, even coming from me. The talent and physicality on that Alabama line is different. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying they can just line up and lean and run. They would like to do that. I'm saying Alabama can create moments with talent. It's just that we haven't seen a lot of those moments created against Indiana this year.
Well, and that's the thing. We could say that if this were last year's Indiana team, they got blown out by Ohio State and hadn't really played anybody else that's kind of that level.
Right.
This team went to Eugene and beat Oregon, which has a roster every bit as talented as Alabama's. And this team beat Ohio State in the Big Ten Championship game, which has Ohio State has a roster better than Alabama's. Ohio State's roster is better than everybody's. So, Ohio State's roster is better than Indiana's, even though Indiana won the game. And I'm not insulting Indiana there. I'm just saying, like, if we just asked NFL scouts who has the most talented roster in America, they will all tell us Ohio State. And that didn't bother Indiana at all.
No, and I think that's just, I think we're kind of dancing around something because, you know, we try not to say the same thing every week, every segment. But so the period of time that we're in right now is that I don't know if you're going to see programs with a vast advantage when you get to this level of the playoff, right? We flatten Correct. Things out at the very top because of the portal. And so if we're talking about Indiana as Alabama of yore, that's not entirely true because like that 2012, 2011, 2013-ish Alabama would have come in a significant favorite and, right. And crushed.
The backups of 2012 Alabama, the backups on that team would have right. been the 10th best team in the country.
Yes. I think it's safer to say this. Indiana is modeled after those teams, but because no one boasts that level of depth anymore, that there's still a path in every one of these matchups. As we go through these previews, we can kind of create a composite or a style, it's like a flavor profile or like, hey, it's
right.
it's a little bit like this and it's a little bit of this or whatever. Bottom line is there are no games left with that feel like foregone conclusions. And this one is like that. I feel like we're trying to talk ourselves into an inevitable, like, yes, Indiana's the better team. Alabama has every right and every chance to win this game.
Yeah. But Indiana's favored for a reason. It's not fluky. Yes. And Alabama is, and I think Kalen DeBoer understands this, and I'm sure that Kalen DeBoer will tell this to his team. Like, this is a significant challenge. This is not, you have the more notice, you know, you have the more famous helmet, therefore you should be confident here. I am sure the Alabama coaching staff is putting the fear of God into those players because the players themselves will turn on the tape and see how consistently good Indiana is.
Yeah. I don't think that's an issue right now. I don't think this is the old days. I don't think this is where Saban would have to lose his mind going into the Citadel week to keep everybody focused.
Yeah, he wouldn't have to send the message through the press conference. I don't think that's going to be necessary.
And Kalen DeBoer enjoys underdog status.
He does.
Not afraid of walking in as an underdog in any stretch.
Great as a multi-touchdown favorite, but
no.
Very good as an underdog. So
Yeah. One could argue that, and that's the difference between the Saban era, because I think a lot of coaches at this level will tell you that walking into a major game as a multi-touchdown favorite, it's actually harder in terms of keeping focus and culture. It's easy to walk in with bulletin board. It's easy to walk in and say, hey, look, they got a plus 10 next to our name on this game because they think you suck. That works really well on 20-year-olds. What doesn't work well is, hey, guys, they think you're so good, but by the way, please don't listen to that.
And that's what Persignetti has to do this week and yes. not Kalen DeBoer. And I think
that
helps.
And he retains a certain sort of like, vintage kind of miserable old man vibe. Like that man's yeah. that man's got some Paul Johnson curmudgeon in him, and this is a compliment. Like I feel like he can stamp any entitlement out.
We're gonna find out because this is the first time that we are, I think, as a nation, as a college football watching nation, respecting them properly.
Yes,
let's see how they handle that because it's a first for them.
I have no bias or want or pick or anything like that with this game. I think it's going to be fascinating to watch. If Alabama wins, great. I would, I'm going to hate working in college football media for a long time. If Alabama were to, for some reason, go in there and win by, you know, double digits and command the game, because like the lazy narrative would be unstoppable for a
there
while.
There would be so much told you so from certain quarters that may not actually be true. It may just be an isolated incident, but yeah, I actually, that feels like the least likely outcome in this game.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely.
But we shall see. Godfrey, we got another fascinating game. This is the one I'm going to be at, the Orange Bowl between Texas Tech and Oregon. We'll talk about it when we come back. We're back at the College Football Inquirer, and I am in lovely Key Largo, Florida right now. I have a very short drive to go cover the Orange Bowl on Thursday. I am very excited about this game, Godfrey. Do we want to talk about this in football terms first, or do we want to talk about it in social media stereotype storylines first?
I feel like I'm zagging on you here, but like I'm interested in the football part of this. Like,
I am too.
Look, God knows we've talked about NIL enough, man. Like, I don't care how the front seven got assembled in Lubbock.
I just think it's really so good. It's so, but that's what makes this funny, because you said you don't care how the front seven got assembled in Lubbock. This is new money against just new money.
Yeah. It's a battle. It's a battle of cul-de-sac mansions.
Yeah. Oregon has become East Egg and Lubbock is now West Egg.
It's like a 2015 lottery winner complaining about a 2024 lottery winner moving into some McMansion. I mean, that's why I'm sort of exhausted by it. I it would be more fun to transpose these against
funny.
Blue Bloods.
I think it's hilarious.
No, it is definitely funny. Yeah.
But also, the Oregon fans are not guilty of this, by the way. The Oregon fans are like, we don't know.
No. In fact, I think, and again, I haven't like scanned for every quote here, but I kind of fell into the Alabama-Indiana preview thing, I think because of the big sort of cudgel of SEC versus fake pretender or Big Ten, you know, North-South. This one, it's funny because the last time anyone said anything really, really critical about some sort of like moral transgression of NIL, it wasn't Texas Tech. It was when Mike Gundy talked a little bit of that smack against Oregon and they dropped 66 on him, 77, something like that. I can't remember what the total
like
in that game was.
69-3 was the final of that game. It was very bad.
Basically disintegrated Mr. Gundy and his mullet. So I don't think you'll have anyone casting aspersions on the construction of either team's roster. I think if you ask Dan Lanning, they're way more concerned about the pass rush and about what they can do up front and about how genuinely horrific Rodriguez and Bailey can make your life and your reads and progressions and decision-making. However, Andy, we got to talk about Texas Tech's offense at some point because a front seven can do a lot of things and defense travels in the playoffs, right? That's a football maxim that I think applies from high school to the NFL. And I think when you get to the postseason, having a defense like theirs and a pass rush is probably the most impactful thing you could have as a unit. But you got to score points. And I'm curious, like, exactly what kind of Texas Tech offense we're going to get here. Because Oregon, by the way, not bad. It's not, it's like we've turned all this into the NIL Texas Tech front. But like, Oregon is very, very good on defense.
Yeah. I mean, Oregon has a plethora of future NFL starters on their defense.
Yeah.
Like, Mateo Uiagalelei is awesome. He's fantastic. Bryce Betcher is awesome. They have a bunch of good players. And that's my question. Because I do think, as good as Texas Tech's defense is, I think Oregon should be able to score on them a little bit. But can Texas Tech consistently score against Oregon? So, you know, I'm looking at that run game. Can, you know, Cameron Dickey, can they get him going? Because if he just runs for his average, Texas Tech's winning this game.
If I like to think myself of some sort of college football progressive, so like I'm not worried about the weirdness of Texas Tech as a national seed or a top seed or whatever. Like, I would give, you know, of the teams that feel like, oh, it's weird that they're showing up, you know, they're here in the NIL, or it's Texas Tech and Ole Miss at this point, right? That are the teams left standing. Texas Tech, I would take their NIL situation or their roster construction over Ole Miss right now, except for the fact that Baron Morton has a leg injury and he's going to have to be some kind of mobile in order for this to work. For them, they have the ability to win the remaining games. They have the ability to go to the national championship because of their defense. However, you still have to be in the neighborhood of 20-plus points. Look at their games this year, right?
Yeah.
Look at the scoring margins. If this is a situation where Oregon is able to hound him early and turn the ball over, I do think, Andy, as good as Tech's defense is, I think Oregon is creative enough to score some points. This feels like a kind of weird and low-scoring game, maybe with a couple chunk plays and a couple sort of chess match moments where maybe Tech overloads in a moment or maybe Oregon finds an open space or something like that. I don't think this is a blowout either way. This is the game I'm most interested in of the four. By the way, I know we weren't voting on any of this. It's just, it feels new and weird and different. And
it's fascinating.
It's strength on strength, to, you know, with the creativity of Oregon's offense. Like, that's another aspect.
What's interesting to me, Godfrey, if we think about it, Oregon's not new anymore. Like,
no.
Oregon has played for the national title twice in the last 15 years.
They're a helmet. They're a legacy brand or whatever you want to call it. I know that, you know, they don't have national titles from the 60s like some other teams, but at this point, I mean, they're 30 years into being a national name.
Yeah. Now, they got Gary Bryant Jr. and DeCorian Moore back. The question is, are they going to get Evan Stewart back, who's been hurt since the spring? He wasn't at practice on Saturday, or at least the reporters didn't see him in the period they could watch. So I don't know that he winds up coming back. That's the thing I was wondering, is if Stewart were to come back, and then you've also got Moore and Bryant back, you know, kind of full speed for the first time really since before the Iowa game, could this be an entirely different Oregon offense than what Texas Tech's really been able to see on film?
In terms of comps, I don't think that on either side of the ball, Oregon is anything that Texas Tech has really seen this season. And that's not a slight against the Big 12. I just think that, again, maybe there's a little bit of an Indiana schedule situation from last season here.
It's a slight against the Big 12. There's nobody in the Big 12.
Well, I was trying to mean, I was trying to be nice. This level of skill talent
and offense. There's nobody close.
No. No, when you were asking about that, like in terms of whether, you know, whether they're totally healthy or not, and then my brain went to, okay, well, what's, if I'm taking a step off of this, what could have simulated this for them? And it's just not there, honestly. You know, there's a physical win at Utah, and then there's physical wins against BYU twice. But when we say physical, that's also code for, hey, they're well coached and they're tough and we like their head coaches and their identities. But like in terms of raw NFL level talent, like it's really hard to find it on the schedule.
The NFL
this
talent, what you're saying is the NFL talent they've seen tends to be on the line of scrimmage. They've not seen a lot of NFL skill in their opposing offenses.
Yeah. Correct. And also like, yeah, it's honestly not even close when you think about the teams that could run something similar to Oregon, like a UCF.
What's the one team that they saw with an NFL quarterback and an NFL wide receiver won?
On their schedule this year?
Mm-hmm. There's one.
Is it Arizona State?
It was. Yeah.
Yeah.
They lost. Yeah. Yeah. Now, granted, Baron Morton didn't play in that game, so Texas Tech was limited offensively. But that is the best quarterback they saw. Sam Levitt's an NFL quarterback. Jordan Tyson, definitely an NFL receiver.
Yeah.
So
that's you know what, Andy, that's kind of scary because everyone is I breezed past that loss as an internal injury related issue with Morton. But you're right in terms of skill position talent. That's probably the best offering they saw. Now, they only scored 26. Right. I mean, it wasn't like they got their doors blown off.
Yeah.
No.
But if Oregon scores 26, does Oregon win this game? I think there's a chance.
Definitely. No, that's what I think is going to happen. I think either way, this is going to be kind of a wonky and somewhat low scoring finish because I think it's going to require some creativity. Hey, you want to talk about like we toss out next day evaluation, we do our Sunday shows. We don't really base things off the first 15. I'm going to be fascinated to see what the first 15 plays for both of these teams look like, what they want to show early and what they're trying to see from the opposing defense, especially when Oregon's on offense. That's going to be really interesting. They have been quiet and conservative and kind of come out in the first round of the boxing match in several big games this year, taking it a little bit, kind of checked out. Okay, like the Iowa game comes to mind. There's a couple other games where I need to pull up Oregon's schedule where they've kind of come out and just evaluated. I think they did this against Washington too off the top of my head.
You just walked me into something.
Yeah.
Do you remember who was like that last year in the regular season and then won their first playoff game and then came out blazing fire in the quarterfinals offensively, taking shots that they hadn't taken all year?
Refresh me.
It was Ohio State against Oregon.
That's what I thought. Okay, that's what I thought you were saying. Yeah. They Oregon weren't fully realized that. Until they got there.
Yeah. Oregon could be that. And that's I said this when the bracket came out. Oregon getting James Madison first rather than having a bye, especially after what happened to Oregon last year, feels like the best thing that could have happened for Oregon. Like they're now lubed up properly and they are ready to go. They have gotten this is how the playoff works out of their system. Cause I mean, when they took the field against Ohio State last year, they had no chance. Ohio State was completely warmed up and ready to operate at premium optimum capacity.
No, that's Oregon, the fastest that I've ever seen a major game end.
Yeah.
I want to say.
Because it's not like that Oregon team stunk. That Oregon team was awesome and they got destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it was that was as definitive and embarrassing a moment as, but it was also, like you said, it was unavoidable. Yeah. I mean, man, that's a big comparison to make. I mean, if you're right, you're going to look like a genius, definitely. I feel hesitant there because
I might do that if I'm Will Stein. Like, no, I know Will Stein's been pulling double duty because he's a new Kentucky head coach.
Yeah.
But yeah. I might, obviously, Dan Lanning has significant input on tone and theme of the first 15, maybe not the exact calls, but he'll tell them, this is what I want tonally. It may be like they may want Kendrick Lamar's Not Like Us to be playing as the plays are run. Like, you think you bought a nice team. We've been buying nice teams.
Yes. I mean, this is going to feel like a no-brainer type of statement. Like, obviously, if you could score quickly and aggressively and put them on their... Put Morton, again, an injured, not 100%, and somewhat suspect. Like, the worst part of Texas Tech's construction right now is a quarterback play. Okay? So, yes, you would love for them to come out on the heels of some, like, chunk play touchdown on play three. That feels like vintage Oregon. That feels like Chip Kelly Oregon, right? You would love for that to happen because the more stress that you put on Morton, the faster Oregon can win this game.
Yeah.
He's the weakest part of their team.
The longer it stays low scoring and close, the better chance the better Texas for Tech has.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. Absolutely.
Yeah, a shootout doesn't favor Texas Tech. And maybe we're wrong. I mean, maybe Texas Tech can win a shootout, but they haven't really needed to, so we don't know if they can. We know Oregon can win both kinds of ways. We've seen Oregon win slogs, and we've seen Oregon win higher scoring games.
Yeah, and I'm hesitant to, I don't know, like I'm not trying to just constantly counteract myself, but like I'm hesitant. We breeze past because of their schedule, the idea that like just because they haven't seen this doesn't mean they're not capable of it. But when you get into the prognostication business where you're doing preview segments like we are right now, there's a lot of unease when you look at what Oregon has versus what you're building Texas Tech's resume out to be. It's not necessarily they're not capable of it, because I think in a lot of games down the stretch this year, they did kind of slip into second and third gear by choice, by design, because they didn't have to. But yeah, we haven't seen a game like this for either one of these teams this year. And again, there is, you know what? We never did the social media part of this, by the way. This is going to piss off. This is going to piss off college football trads either way, because either team winning this, I don't. Do you still feel this with Oregon? Like, because we're both in like hardcore SEC country, and you know, in college football media, Oregon used to really like rankle traditional college football fan bases. I feel like because we're like a generation through it, if Oregon shows back up at the national title game, I don't think it's going to be as pearl clutching as it once was with their fancy helmets and their uniforms. Yeah.
Oregon's a Big Ten team now. I almost think the SEC fans enjoy Oregon coming into the Big Ten, like winning the Big Ten their first year.
Yeah.
Because they're not the stodgy, boring Big Ten, which, let's be real, neither is Ohio State. Neither was that Michigan team that won the national title. Like, they're not. The stereotype of the Big Ten is wrong. But Oregon,
they think it's 18 Iowas, and it's not.
Right, exactly. But Oregon coming in and winning that, I think, probably broke a little bit of the, oh, I'm against this new thing. It's more like now, oh, yeah, they've been really good. I like them better than those other teams. So I'm okay with them now.
I would say this, man, like based on the national perception of Oregon.
Also, people love Lanning. Everybody loves Lanning.
Yeah. And, well, that's the coach you would hire if you could hire anybody, right? If you're the casual fan. The national perception of Oregon, even we're talking over a 25-year span, is largely built on big moment postseason games. And we've talked this to death about how they changed in the trenches and they changed with Mario. And now it's a fact under Dan. Like they operate like a top end Big Ten team, right? They are line focused and line
or
built
SEC.
And they can run.
I mean,
absolutely. Yeah. Like a power two team, I should say.
Yeah.
They can run on you. They can be creative, but they're not afraid of the physicality. They are not that 2014 national title team anymore. But the nation hasn't had a chance. And this is why the Rose Bowl was so detrimental to the Oregon brand.
Yeah.
The nation hasn't had a chance to see Oregon on the biggest stages possible hold serve and command 3.5 yards if that's what it takes and control a game. So this is an opportunity, and maybe the next game against a bluer blood would be a better opportunity, but it has to start now for them to change that narrative.
The bluer blood if chalk holds is Indiana, by the way.
I mean, you take what you're given. It'd be a revenge game. You take what you're given.
Speaking of chalk,
we're just gonna have to get used to Indiana, folks. Like, I'm sorry, exactly. You're just gonna have to get used to it.
Speaking of chalk in Vegas, by the way, Oregon is a 1.5-point favorite in the season. It's essentially a pick'em. So it's gonna be fun. I'm excited. I don't know what's gonna happen. I love that we've talked ourselves into about 6 different outcomes.
Definitely, yeah.
That's the kind of game you want. I'm just excited to see it. I'm excited for all of these individually. They all have their own little unique flavor that makes them exciting. And we're going to get into the Cotton Bowl and the Sugar Bowl in the next episode. And obviously, there again, many flavors to Miami, Ohio State, which obviously has the historical flavor, the current flavor. And then, of course, Georgia Ole Miss, which you've already seen. But then there's the whole No Lane Kiffin of it all. Oh boy, it's gonna be a blast.
Did you catch America's favorite divorced dad in his leather jacket last night on the Texas Bowl?
Oh yeah, listen, it's the only reason to watch the Texas Bowl.
Yeah,
congratulations to Willie Fritz and the Cougars, by the way.
Dude, somebody hire Willie Fritz one day. Just telling you, keep being right about that.
If Kyle Whittingham works, I think Willie Fritz and Lance Leipold will be the next beneficiaries of it.
Somebody needs to hire Willie Fritz. If Michigan's in the playoff next year, Willie Fritz is getting hired by somebody for sure. Well,
there was going to be the biggest bidding war over Willie Fritz. Like imagine,
as there should be.
Imagine the Big Ten championship game is Kurt Cignetti's Indiana against Kyle Whittingham's Michigan, and they both wind up, you know, top 4 seeds in the playoff. Willie Fritz is going to be in such demand, it's not even going to be funny.
You know what? It's the Centrum Silver Classic. You know what? Maybe the boomers still have something left to teach us.
Exactly. We will talk to you on Tuesday.